Chapter 14. A Prince of Egypt. When Amuba recovered his senses, he was lying in a heap at the bottom of the chariot. Two men were standing in the car beside him. In a few minutes, the chariot turned off through a stately gateway. The driver leaped down and closed the gates, and then led the horses to the steps leading up to a splendid mansion. The man beside him called out, and two or three slaves ran down the steps. Then Amuba was lifted out, carried into the house, and laid upon a couch. A cup of wine was placed to his lips, and after he had drunk, a slave bathed his head with cold water and bandaged up the numerous cuts from which blood was flowing. This greatly refreshed him, and he raised himself on his arm. An order was given, and the slaves left the apartment. Amuba, looking up, saw a tall, stately figure standing before him. Amuba recognized him at once, for he had seen him among the princes of Egypt in one of the processions.
"Who are you? And is it true what those men whom I found maltreating you averred, that you are the slayer of the cat of Bubastes?"
"My name is Amuba, my lord. I am a Rebu taken prisoner of war, and handed as a slave to Ameres, high priest of Osiris. I am not the slayer of the cat, but it is true that I was present at its death, and that it might just as well have been my arrow that accidentally pierced it."
"Then it was an accident," the noble said.
"It was wholly an accident, my lord. We fired at a hawk that had been thinning the pet birds of my master's daughter. One of the arrows struck a tree, and glancing off, entered the house in which the cat was kept, and unfortunately caused its death. We regretted the accident bitterly, knowing how sacred was the animal in the sight of the Egyptians."
"But not in your sight? You were not yet a follower of the gods of the Egyptians?"
"I am not, my lord, but at the same time I would not upon any account have willfully done anything to offend the religious opinions of others."
"Then you worship the gods of your own people?"
Amuba was silent for a moment. I would answer frankly, my lord, and I hope that you will not be displeased. Since I have come to Egypt, I have come to think that neither the gods of the Egyptians nor the gods my fathers worshipped are the true gods. I believe there is one great God over all, and that the others are, as it were, his attributes, which men worship under the name of gods.
The Egyptian uttered an exclamation of surprise. "Whence did you obtain such a belief as this?"
Amuba was silent. The noble went on,
"It must have been from Ameres himself. But how came it that he should speak of such matters to you, a slave?"
"He never spoke of this until after the accident of the cat. My friend Kebron was utterly cast down at the sin that he thought he had committed, and would at once have denounced himself, preferring death to living with such a burden upon his mind. Then his father, Ameres, seeing that his whole life would be embittered, and that he would probably be forced to fly from Egypt and dwell in some other land, told him the belief which he himself held. I believed this all the more readily because I had heard much the same from an Israelite maiden who served my master's daughter."
Again Amuba's listener uttered an exclamation of surprise. "I knew not that there was an Israelite who still adhered to the religion of their ancestors."
"Well, the maiden told me that for the most part they had taken to the worship of the Egyptians, and indeed, so far as she knew, she was the last who clung to the old belief. She had been brought up by her grandfather, who had instructed her in the faith he held, which was that there was only one God over all the earth."
"Do you know who I am?" the noble asked abruptly.
"I know that you are one of the princes of the land, my lord."
"I also am an Israelite. It seems strange to you, doubtless," he went on, as Amuba started in astonishment. "Many years ago, at the time I was an infant, there was a great persecution of the Israelites, and my father and mother, fearing for my life, placed me in a little cradle and set me afloat on the water. It chanced, or was it chance, or the will of God, that the water took me to the spot where the daughter of the then king was bathing with her maidens. She had compassion upon me and adopted me. And as I grew up, I had all the rights and privileges of her son and rank with the princes of Egypt. She called me Moses, for that was the name, it seems, that was writ upon a piece of papyrus fastened to the cradle. I was instructed in all the learning of the Egyptians, and grew up as one of them. So I lived for many years, and had almost forgotten that I was not one of them. But now... And here he stopped and began thoughtfully to pace up and down the apartment. Then he asked suddenly, "What has become of the maiden of whom you spoke?" "I know not, my lord. Upon the day that Amaris was murdered by the mob, his little daughter was carried off, and Ruth has also been missing ever since. It is for that reason we have lingered here, otherwise we should have fled at once."
"You and the son of Amaris?"
"Yes, my lord. And another Rebu, one of my father's warriors, who was a fellow captive with me, and also slave of Amaris. But when we found that my young mistress was missing, we decided to remain to search for her."
"What will you do when you find her?"
"If we can rescue her from those who have carried her away, we shall hand her over to her mother, and then leave the land, as we had intended. Unless you, my lord, in your goodness, could obtain for Kebron a pardon for an offense which was wholly accidental."
"That I can never do.
The king himself could not withstand the demand of the populace for your friend's life. If you find this little Israelite maiden, tell her she is not the last of the Israelites who believes in the God of Abraham, our ancestor. Tell her that Moses also holds to the faith." "You again look surprised, young man, and you may well be so. But our priests keep accurate records of all things connected with the countries and religions of the people with whom we come in contact. Thus it was easy for me, who have access to all these stores of knowledge, to examine the rolls recording the first coming of my people, the rule of Joseph, the great governor, the coming of his relations here, and their settlement in the country. And thus I learned that they worshipped one God, whom they believed to be the only God in the world. I heard reports that Amaris was bold enough to entertain the idea that there was only one God. Therefore, I said to myself, I too will believe in the one God worshipped by my forefathers, hoping that in time it may be that I may learn more of him. Until the last 2 or 3 years, I have been content to live as one of the Egyptian princes. But of late my heart has turned much to my oppressed people. I have determined upon doing what I can to relieve their burden. I have even raised my voice in the council in their favor. This has only created a coldness between the court and myself. But I feel moved by a spirit stronger than my own. But we must talk no longer. Do you think that you can walk?" "Yes," Amuba replied, getting up and walking across the apartment. "I have not lost much blood. I was only dizzy from their blows."
"Then it is better that you should leave at once. The people from whom I took you will have carried the news speedily to the city, and officials will doubtless soon arrive to demand that you be given up to them. Therefore, take another draught of wine and some food. I will then give you in charge of a trusty slave who will guide you to any spot where you may wish to go. When the officials arrive, I shall tell them the truth, that I came upon a lad who was being attacked or murdered by a number of brutal peasants, and I carried him off in my chariot, that I questioned you upon your arrival here and let you depart by the garden gate in order to escape the fury of your persecutors." Moses drew back the curtains from before the entrance to the chamber, and he clapped his hands. He then ordered the servant who answered the call to tell Mephres to come to him. An old slave speedily appeared. Moses ordered him to take Amuba out by the private way and to guide him back to the city. Then he hurried him away, for he knew that at any moment the officials might arrive from the city. It was well that Amuba had been supplied with a guide, for he found that only with difficulty could he direct his steps. The old slave, seeing that Amuba stumbled as he walked, placed his staff in one of Amuba's hands, and taking him firmly by the arm, led him steadily onward. Less than an hour after starting, his conductor found that he could go no further, and led Amuba aside into an orchard. There he laid him down under the shelter of a tree, covering him with one of his own garments. Amuba fell asleep, and slept all the remainder of the night, while the old man kept watch. When the slave perceived the first faint gleam of morning in the sky, he aroused Amuba. The lad found he could now walk at a brisk pace, and at his request the slave led him towards the hills, where Amuba hoped to conceal himself once more. Here he took leave of his guide with many warm thanks for his kindness, and with a message of gratitude to his lord. Then Amuba ascended the hill for a short distance and laid himself down among some great boulders. Although greatly refreshed by his night's rest, he was still weak and shaken, and he felt altogether unequal to making his way along the hills for the 4 miles or so which intervened between himself and the hiding place of his friends. He was soon asleep again, and the sun was already some distance down the sky when he awoke. He waited until it sank behind the brow of the hill above him, and then, climbing some distance higher, made his way along the hillside. Darkness had just fallen when he arrived at the tomb they used as their shelter. A figure was standing there in deep shadow. As Amuba turned the path and approached, it advanced to meet him. Then there was a cry of joy, and Jethro sprang forward and clasped Amuba in his arms. "My dear Amuba, I never thought to see you again." A moment later Kebron ran out, and in his turn embraced his friend. "I shall never forgive you, and I shall never forgive myself," he said reproachfully. "What right had you to take my danger upon yourself? It was wrong, Amuba, and I have suffered horribly. Even though we are like brothers, why should you sacrifice yourself for me?" Amuba was about to burst into remonstrance when Jethro touched him as a sign to be silent. The older Rebu knew how acutely Kebron had suffered, and how he had spent the night in self-reproaches, and he felt that it was better to allow his present agitation to pass before arguing with him. "Are you hungry, Amuba?" he asked. "That I am, Jethro, and you'll get no news out of me until I have eaten and drunk." A meal of cakes and cool fish and a draught of wine were soon taken, and Amuba said, "Now I will tell you all about it." Amuba then related the whole tale of his flight, his attack by the peasants, and his rescue, and then he recited the whole of his conversation with his rescuer, Moses, and his proceedings after leaving his house. "It is a strange story," Jethro said when Amuba brought his narrative to a conclusion. "You have had a marvelous escape. Had it not been for the arrival of this prince upon the spot at the very moment, you must have been killed. Had he not been of a compassionate nature, he would never in the first place have interfered on your behalf. And had it not been for your common faith, he would certainly have held you until the officials arrived to claim you. Then, too, you were fortunate in the kindness of your guide. Above all, I consider it extraordinary that you should at the critical moment have been rescued by, well, perhaps the one man in Egypt who would have had the will and the courage to save you." The following morning it was resolved that in future, as a better disguise, Kebron should be attired as a woman, and that the watch upon the house of Tylus should be renewed, but that they should station themselves further away from the gates. Amuba's disguise was completely altered. He was still in the dress of a peasant, but by means of pigments obtained from Kigron, Jethro so transformed him as to give him the appearance of advanced years. They had a long discussion as to the plan they would adopt. "We must find out which way Plexo goes to begin with," Kebron said. "After that, none of us need go near the house. I will buy a basket and some flowers from one of the peasant women who bring them in, and will take my seat near the gate. By 3 o'clock, Plexa will have finished his offices in the temple and may set out half an hour later. I shall see at least which road he takes. Then when you join me at dusk, one of you can walk a mile or two along the road, and the other twice as far. We shall then see when he returns whether he has followed the road any considerable distance or has turned off by any crossroads, and then we can post ourselves on the following day so as to find out more.
Accordingly, that afternoon, Cabron, dressed as a peasant woman, took his seat with a basket of flowers 50 yards from the entrance to the house of Tylus. At about the time he expected, Plexo and his father returned together from the temple. Half an hour later, a light chariot with 2 horses issued from the gate. Plexo was driving, and an attendant stood beside him. Cabron felt sure that if Plexo was going to visit Mysa, he would take the road leading into the country, and the post he had taken up commanded a view of the point where the road divided into 3, one running straight north along the middle of the valley, while the others bore right and left, until one fell into the great road near the river, and the other into that on the side of the valley near the hills. It was this last road Plexo took. As soon as it was dark, Cabron was joined by Jethro and Amuba, and exclaimed as they came up to him, "He started at 3 o'clock, and took the road leading to the foot of the hills."
"We will go on there at once," Jethro said. "You walk quietly on, Cabron, and stop at the point where the road runs into the main road. Amuba, you shall stop 2 miles further, and I will go 2 miles further still. If Plexo comes along the road past me, we will begin at that point tomorrow."
Jethro had just reached the spot at which he proposed to wait when he heard the sound of the wheels approaching, and a minute later the chariot drove along. The moon was not up, but the night was clear and bright, and advancing as close as he could to the passing chariot, he was able to recognize Plexo. A minute later the chariot had disappeared, and Jethro returned towards the city, picking up on his way Amuba and Cabron. The next night, Amuba took up his station 1 mile beyond the spot at which Jethro had seen the chariot, and then Jethro 1 mile ahead, while Cabron watched the crossroads near the town. But this time the chariot did not come along, although Cabron had seen him start the same hour as before. It was not, indeed, until the 4th night of waiting that Plexo came along. This time he did not pass Jethro at all, and it was therefore certain that he had turned off from the main road either to the right or left, at some point between the post of Jethro and that of Amuba. When this was determined, they agreed not to return to their hiding places near Thebes that night, but to lie down under some trees by the roadside until morning broke, and then to examine the road carefully. It was not likely that another chariot would pass before morning, and they might be able to follow the tracks along the dusty road. In this way they discovered the road where Plexo had turned off. But beyond this the tracks did not show, as the road was hard and almost free of dust. After some discussion it was agreed they should ascend the hills and remain there during the day, and that Jethro should return to the town as soon as it became dark, and obtain a store of provisions sufficient to last them for 1 week. This was done, and the next day they separated at dawn and took up their places on the hills, at a distance of 1 mile apart, choosing spots where they commanded a view over the valley, and arranging to meet at a central point when night came on.